right? Those squads are 178 apiece. So you have three of those, right?
That would also require me to have more than one bike.
Say what?
That would require me to have more than one bike.
Yeah, so?
Buy more models.
Damn, son.
And Dennis, this is just what Dave's putting together for himself. This isn't what he's specifically telling you you have to run.
Well, I know.
If you do not run your list exactly as Dave says, then you are playing the game wrong.
Well, I play the game wrong a lot.
Welcome to Preferred Enemies, the Undercover Network Warhammer 40K podcast. I'm your host, Rob.
Kevin.
Dennis.
And Richard.
And we are joined today by David Ehrman and Andrew Teagues of the Renegade Open. How you doing, guys?
Doing great.
And we are all here. This is not going to be your typical Preferred Enemies episode, and I know we've been gone for a while, and we will get back to our normal order of things in a couple of weeks. But we are going to finally get around to recording our coverage of the 2018 Midwest Conquest, GT and otherwise, because we're also going to be talking Combat Patrol, and also talking about the turnout of the Night Joust as well, because we've got some interesting stories. So there will be no news and new releases, and honestly, we've had like three codexes since our last recording, so take your pick, although all the news right now is Age of Sigmar anyway. So
the Webway Portal came out. It's awesome.
Yeah. And new knights are...
And new codexes announced.
Yeah. Yeah, two new codexes coming out because we're finally getting Orcs and Space Wolves on the schedule. But as I said, we're not really going into those in depth. We're not doing your listener questions. Like I said, we'll be getting back to that. We are going to get this one done because it is long delayed and you guys deserve to have a show. So... here we go. Midwest Conquest was Memorial Day weekend this year in Kansas City, Missouri at the Sheridan Crown Center, as it has been for the last 2 years before it. And I'd like to think that every year we get better and better at doing it, although every year we also have our own moments of panic and discovering and things not quite working or trying, you know, like thinking that things are not going to work at the last minute. But so you guys both played in the GT. And how do you think we did, Dave and Andrew?
I got to play my own missions. Yay!
Yay!
And how
I
did
got
this...
my ass whooped?
Yay! While wearing our jersey. Yay!
Yay! Yes, as is tradition.
Yes, we officially gave Dave a Preferred Enemies jersey because he is our official fifth chair at this point. He has been on the show enough times that he is effectively a member of the crew. And
woo-hoo!
And in fine Preferred Enemies tradition, he proceeded to get his ass whooped at the GT while wearing it.
Yay! I can do it too, guys. See, it's not just you.
I successfully finished in the middle of the pack.
Yes, you did.
A nice, good, solid 3-3 finish.
Hey, that is a nice a nice 50-50 straight down the midline. Can't complain with that.
But and most important thing is, I mean, I had a blast. It was a really good time. I enjoyed all of my matches, and I feel for as far as GTs went, I felt personally that it was one of the most relaxed atmospheres I've been in at a major tournament. Everybody was friendly. Everybody was having a good time. My opponents were all brilliant, great guys who I'd happily play again. And that's what more can you ask for, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say the sportsmanship scores we got back from everyone, there were very few cases where people did not score a full 5 of 5 for the round. I think there were a couple of cases where you had opponents where they got into a couple of rules disputes and then they did not like each other's list and said, yeah, I don't know if I would play this again. I even saw one that was like circled no, but said player yes, list no. So everyone was generally pretty chill with everyone. Rules questions tended to be resolved relatively quickly. There was actually more rules adjudication than I think I expected for with 8th edition, although a lot of it was still people figuring out rules interactions or not being clear on this or that, or discovering that they'd been playing something wrong the whole time.
Or some that I know we got called over for, we were just things that had never come up before.
Right. Trying to figure out, like, if finding similar situations. The same kind of thing we do when people write us rules. So that has been good experience for us. We also had a number of cases where we would get called over, and then by the time a judge got there, they'd be like, oh, no, wait, we figured it out.
Yeah.
But overall, I mean, no fist fights. There wasn't I mean, we had would have somebody like wave over a judge, but I never heard somebody yell like "judge," you know, at any point.
I think there was only one instance where the two players were really
salty
at each other when one of them left.
Yeah, I think we had one case, and I'm not going to name names on anybody because I don't want to. There's no reason to throw anybody under the bus. But we had like one case where the game was over, it had been scored, and then one player discovered that the other player had been playing something slightly incorrect. I was called over. I showed the rules where it's like, yes, you had been playing this incorrectly. The player insisted it was an honest mistake. His opponent agreed that the outcome of the game, like win or loss, wouldn't have changed, all just saying that he might have scored more points. His opponent agreed. We awarded them awarded the loser a few extra points just to – both players agreed on it. Everything was fine. I think afterwards the player who lost then said, no, maybe I should have won that game, but you don't get to decide that after we've adjudicated it and you've agreed upon a resolution. So, But other than that, I mean, I don't think we had any big blowups. Everything seemed to move smoothly. Again, huge props to Best Coast Pairings. On making their app better and better every year. And our Dan, our data entry guy, basically it was just a matter of looking at sheet, make sure points are right, especially double checking in if they've self-entered, and it was really painless.
Although we did have to fix our Ringer McRingerson score.
Well, yes, we forgot that that ringers are always supposed to get 0 points when
we gave them a loss, but we put the points in, and that started putting the ringer in the middle of the pack, which wasn't.
So we got that fixed for day two.
Yes.
Whoops.
Yeah. Not
lessons learned.
Yeah. So yeah, because last year we used the ringer a little bit, but it's been a year since I've used the ringer, yeah. So.
Well, this is the first time we've done it with pure points.
Right, right. And actually, that was one thing that was made this, I think, easier to score than past usage of the Renegade missions. It was the change to the mission packet where it wasn't primary was worth 12, 6, or 0 points, depending on, or I guess back, it would have been 8 and 4 previously, and then mm-hmm. 8, 4, 0 for Maelstrom, and then your tertiaries. This one, it was just however many points you earned, that's what you had. So we didn't have to check, did you win this one and lose this one? Make sure your points added up right. No, it's just like, how many points did you earn? Okay, that's how many points you have. Move on.
And one thing I
kind of like that. It allowed me to earn some points on the matches I lost.
Right. And then another thing I noticed just walking around and talking to people, we had a lot of matches that were 20-something to 20-something where it was just decided by 2 or 3 points. And just seeing those scores come in like that, you could tell, wow, that was a really close game that was just bloody in both sides. And that's something you wouldn't see in the previous versions of this.
I believe that Trent Northington, who ended up taking best overall but still not best general because he lost a match, the match he lost, what, did he still ended up with 28 points?
Yeah, it was like 29 to 28 or something like that. It was very, very close. And actually, that was something we also saw time-wise. It's like the first day, games were ending all over the place. I mean, there were a lot of games that ended within the first, you know, a good number of games that ended within the first hour of the match or first hour and a half. And then they would start to trickle in as round time went on. Whereas day two, once everyone's kind of settled into their area, you had a lot more of those very close games where they go pretty much all the way to the wire. So, I mean, you can really tell the format was encouraging games to go the full length and not nearly as many like early tablings as people hit their proper skill and competition level.
Well, round three, I tabled my opponent, and when I did so, I had 3 models of my own left on the table.
So a clear win because of the tabling, but still a hard fought win.
Yeah, it was a great match.
Now, one thing, one change we did make over past years and compared to some other GTs that have been going on recently, is we did increase our round length to 3 hours from 2.5 hours. And one, I'll be absolutely upfront on that. One reason is we really didn't want to go with chess clocks this year, and we've sent out our feedback survey, and I know we're still getting answers on that. But Kevin, what numbers are we seeing on how people felt about whether or not we should have included chess clocks?
Kevin's not here.
Kevin dropped.
Seriously?
Yeah, his computer crashed again.
Damn it.
Although I did see those numbers myself, and it looked like overwhelmingly people did not want chess clocks.
Yeah, no. So from the numbers we're getting back from our feedback survey, which we've still got some answers coming in, but it looks like it's something like a 75-25 split against chess clocks, although the 25 very much want chess clocks. In fact, we had one player come up like after two or three of his games.
At least the first day, every round that he turned in his sheet, he mentioned
like wouldn't gotten further if we'd been using chess clocks or yep. Or there one round he's like, yeah, for the last hour we decided to split our time and hey, we finished the game on time. It's like, you could have done that without us having to tell you, but that's okay. And I think that those 3 hour rounds helped. I would like to think, and so please correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like those helped contribute to that slightly more relaxed feel, because you weren't at, with the extra half hour, you're not as under the gun to make decisions as fast or to be worried that you're burning up time by taking a little bit of time to look at the situation and figure out what the right play is.
And I think, especially on the second day, like a lot of games finished within that last half hour.
Right.
So I think it made a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, I know some people have like looked at like adding 15 minutes and that doesn't seem to make enough of a difference, but I think an extra half hour does give both players a chance to get through at least another turn. Now, I know we had some games where, yes, they only got to like turn three after 3 hours, but it seemed like those were more outliers. And now again, I have not collated through all of the paper sheets, which again, props to our data entry guy, Dan, who basically went through and sorted every single sheet by round, by table number. So I will be able to go through those and analyze all of those.
Making sure that we had all matched sets.
Yeah. And, yeah. Dan was fantastic. And I also want to throw out props to Greg Timms, who basically ended up being our extra floor judge. He was actually someone who had from one of our local play groups here in Kansas City, who was going to play in the event, and had his wife ended up having car troubles that he needed to take time to repair, which meant he wasn't going to have time to finish painting his army. So he contacted us and he said, "Well, I'm not going to be able to play because my army's not going to be painted, so I have to drop out of the event, but my crew and I are still going to be there. I mean, I'm going to have a hotel room all weekend. So is there anything I can do to help out?" And I said, "Well, you run events, so why don't you be our extra floor judge?" And I think having six people between the four of us and Dan and Greg was just right. That was the number, because we had one person on dedicated data entry. We basically had two floor judges at all times. We had me available as head judge. We'd have somebody able to handle our raffle tickets or any other miscellaneous business. And then somebody else could take a break or run and
play the ringer.
Play the ringer army. So that worked out really well. But yeah, I felt like once the event really got going, it did have that more relaxed feel. Although, I mean, games were still intense, especially as they got, you know, into day two.
Well, as a player, I guess I'd like to add in my two cents on it. I didn't have any of my games go towards 3 hours, and I would say that the game of mine that took the longest finished at the 2.5. And then I felt like the days actually ended up going a little bit long, in particular with how late the night joust got started on Saturday night. That didn't get over until after midnight. And personally, I would have liked to see slightly shorter rounds, because I feel like the day ended up being almost as long as if we were doing four rounds in a day. But it was still only three. Personally, I'm a more bigger fan of fewer points, but still the 2.5 hour limit. That's my personal opinion and take on it. I feel like 3 hours is a little bit too much. I didn't think it was a huge problem. I didn't hate it. But my opinion is I'd rather do 2.5 with smaller points.
Which is interesting, because, you know, smaller points is just as controversial, because you have players. I mean, you have players who definitely don't want to drop below 2K. They want to have as many toys as they can. I know last year when we dropped from 1850 to 1650, there we got pushback, and we got a number of people who canceled because they're like, well, if I can't bring that extra 200 points, I don't want to bring anything. And so, yeah, dropping to 1650. I know we originally announced 1650, and then I will admit we kind of immediately pulled back to 2K after our own test experiences didn't seem to bear out that they sped up the game. I know you guys have had different experiences up in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, and this is just, you know, one player's personal opinion on it. I found that it does speed the games up a little bit, but at the same time, you know, at 2,000 points, I still had one of my games finish in under an hour. It just really depends on the kind of lists that people are bringing and the matchups you have as to how long games are going to take.
And speaking of the lists that people brought, I saw a very nice variety of lists, too. And I think
great variety.
I think the rule of three has definitely helped. There were a few units that you saw within their particular faction. Like I saw a fair number of Crimson Hunters for Eldar lists, but I didn't see any one army type that seemed to be dominating everything.
So according to our survey data, the most represented armies are Astra Militarum at 12.5%. And then also, let's see here, what was the other one? Adeptus Custodes, also at 12.5%.
Yeah.
And then everything else fell off rather rapidly from there down in as low as, 2%.
Yeah, and I would put Custodes.
One orc army?
Yeah, one orc army. I would put
three necrons,
including including third place. Sam Henley was actually in the final round with necrons. Our top table in round six was Tau versus necrons.
Really surprising.
Yeah. So there was a good variety. All the necron lists used tesseract vaults to some degree. There were a lot of riptides for the Tau lists. But I mean, that's not unusual to say, like, yeah, you're in a tournament list. What's the strongest thing in your army? Take at least one of those. But
I do believe that every single Tyranid army had three Hive Tyrants.
Well, yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah,
did you just probably say that the sky is blue and water is wet?
Yes,
I believe you just said that the sky is blue and water is wet.
But
I
mean, at least it wasn't like seven was Hive Tyrants.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, personally, I only own five, so yeah, I couldn't have brought seven.
Well, you could have. It would just require you to buy two more.
I think he's saying rule of three stops it.
Well, yeah. Well, no, rule of three does stop it, but without rule of three, he could have bought and brought two more.
This is true. He could have.
I believe I could fit rule. Eight in at 2,000 points.
Nine, actually. There was a list at Adepticon that had nine. It was nine and Rippers, and that was it.
Well, that sounds like a fun list to play and play against.
Yeah, top 16.
Yeah, there's a reason why Adepticon caused the rule of three to be instituted.
Mm-hmm. It sure did.
And I
had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, four out of the top 16 lists had, you know, five or more Hive Tyrants, or that, you know, another six of those lists had, Supreme Command detachments with Custode Bikers, or, you know, anything crazy like that. Nah, nothing to do with any of that.
No, nothing to do with that at all. But no, I think the rule of three is probably one of the least controversial of the new beta rules, and I think it plays out that it is actually really good for army variety.
Well, I will say, if we're talking beta rules there, the reserve one, I think, came into play a lot because you saw people actually holding things in reserve to wait to turn two to drop them in their opponent's deployment zone. That kind of gave the opponent at least one turn to kind of position a little bit after. So I thought that was a nice change.
Well, yeah, it was pretty significant for me because, like, I was used to saying, oh, I'm just going to hold all my Hive Tyrants in reserve and they're just going to drop in your face on my turn one and deal with it. Now they got to wait till turn two, which takes away a lot of my Alpha Strike capability. So, yeah, it was a game changer for sure.
Yeah, and part of that also is the fact that, you know, the internet likes to rage against change.
That it does.
We see that all the time. But realistically, the majority of people out there that were playing things in reserve were not bringing them all in on turn one. Like, the one or two units of what they had in reserve were coming on. Everything else was sitting back, waiting for that turn two or three, because you got to wait till all the chaff gets cleared out. Then you can come down and actually be in some place that was useful. So it's not like this is a super massive game changer to have, you know, any of this happen immediately versus on turn two. It's not that big of a change. What it does do, however, is it frees up a ton of people's options in terms of how many points they had to dictate towards chaff, towards just dumb, small, cheap units that literally serve no other purpose in the game other than to eat up space and keep people from deep striking or charging other units.
Yay, and scouts, sentinels, and scouts.
And I think that is the far bigger and better impact to the game than any of the, you know, let's stop the Alpha Strike nonsense, you know, with this rule could ever be. Because there's still tons of armies out there that are insano fast that can get to you on turn one, no problem. Dark Eldar jet bikes, looking at, you know, Death Company with
Blood Angels stratagems. Still got it going on, yeah.
Yeah. It's
Kraken Gene Stealers.
Kraken Gene Stealers. You know, there's just tons of options. Even rhino-bound berserkers get an extra, you know, basically 4 inches off of their movement just by coming out of that dang thing, because only a part of the base actually has to be within 3 inches when they get out of the box, and then they still go their six. That's, you know, that's that's quite a long ways. So you warp time that unit, and bam, baby, you're there, and there ain't nothing anybody can do to stop you. So, you know, there's plenty of options in this game for that to still go on. So I don't think this is really that big of a change in terms of the game itself, the way it's being played. It just changes what people have to bring in order to prevent the first turn charge or to have enough chaff available so that Alpha Strikes do not just chew apart armies. And that's the biggest change I see from that.
Yeah, and it just seems like it has made for better, more interesting games for both players involved.
Absolutely.
Yeah. 40K, in my opinion, is as good as it's been since I've started playing. And I started playing like early to mid 5th edition. And I think it's more fun now than it's ever been.
Well, and you have to give props to GW for the approach of actually looking at what's going on and stopping and saying, okay, this is not what we had in mind. And the fact that they're going to these large events and they're very carefully watching what's going on and seeing if it jibes with what they had in mind for how the game really should be playing and being willing to admit, yeah, okay, so when we put this out there, we really didn't think this through as much as we thought we had, even with all the playtesting that was done.
Yeah, no playtesting group is ever going to catch everything. Like, let us all sit back for just a moment and realize that it doesn't matter whether you're talking this game, another game, software development, architectural design, whatever. No first draft, heck, no, not even any second or third draft is ever the final product that is like perfect and can be used. Right, there's always real world testing and adjustments that have to be done no matter what. All right. Yeah. So yes, the playtest, anytime somebody says playtesters should have caught this, they're testing a ton of different stuff and they may not necessarily be focused on the thing that you have found.
Yeah. Right? Just look at the scale of 40K. Look at how many armies and units there are. It would be an impossible task to perfectly balance all of them.
It is, in fact, an impossible task. You can't do it. There's no way to balance every single unit in every single situation. It's not possible. What is possible, however, is to have a balance of overall outcome, which is what we should really be looking for, is saying, hey, I just want an army that doesn't, you know, absolutely suck in every situation. That is doable. That is absolutely doable. But saying that every unit is balanced in every situation, no, that can't happen. It's just not feasibly possible. There's not enough time, resources, or research available in the world to do that.
Yeah, and GW these days is doing really the best you can expect them to, so good on them.
Not just of them. They're doing the best you could expect of anybody. Like, let's be honest, they're the king of the hill right now when it comes to this sort of thing. They really
are. Yeah, and 3 years ago, we never would have imagined saying that.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean,
right. And considering the amount of content that they're releasing in this amount of time, like, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are now coming up on 1 year of 8th edition, and what we've got, two previously released codexes that are going to be dropping within the next month. I mean, Orcs and Space Wolves, you know, two major faction codexes that will be dropping soon, and that will almost get everything from all the indexes updated. I mean, after that, we're left with Sisters, which we know are coming.
Gene Stealer Cults.
And Agents of the Imperium.
Yeah, and then
there's probably going to be a Slaanesh, maybe.
That would be neat. I would love to see it, but we'll see. And also, I still think if there's an Agent of the Imperium, there should be an Eldari. Not Eldari.
An Inari. The Inari pamphlet?
Yeah.
But, I mean, even looking over at... And keep in mind, they're doing all this, and they're also in the middle of revamping Age of Sigmar and, like, revealing things like... Hey, yeah, that whole idea of measuring from model and not base, yeah, that was dumb. Let's pretend that never happened and just measure from bases like everyone was already doing anyway. So, I mean, they're willing to go in and say, yeah, everyone was doing this anyway, so we'll just make it official because, yeah. So, how many game companies do you know that are going to just go back and say, yeah, we're still on this rule set, this is... We just really need to tweak these major things that, yeah, weren't good ideas.
None, because GW is kind of a pioneer on that. I mean, you can point to like some specialist games or small developer type games that have been doing it, but they had a much smaller audience and a smaller product to do that with. You can't really point to anything anywhere remotely close to the scale that Games Workshop works on in terms of, you know, Warhammer 40K and Age of Sigmar / Warhammer Fantasy Battle in terms of just how much is going on and therefore how responsive they can be.
Right. And you can and that enthusiasm has definitely carried over to the fan base. We had our biggest turnout yet. We had 77 players. Actually, we had 83 signed up, and then we had like, I think we had three people who hadn't paid yet and didn't show. Okay, that's all right, fine. And then we had, I think, three people who were planning on going, but either like they were sick or they had deaths in the family or something, you know, some other extenuating circumstance that kept them from coming. So we ended up with 77 players. We did three rounds Saturday, three rounds Sunday, and we had zero drops between days, which I was really impressed by, because you usually expect you're going to have, what, like 5%? That are going to, like, especially local players who are like, yeah, I'm not doing that good, I'm just going to stay home, or I'll just stay in the hotel room, I don't really feel like playing. I think we had one player drop after round four because he's like, I'm not in the running for anything and I want to get back home. So, but
yeah, and he said he had like a 12 and a half hour drive. So, Understandable.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, if it's like
he had to go back to North Dakota, I don't blame him.
Right, but I mean, if you have that many players who are willing to, you know, other, you know, they're willing to see it through to the end, even if they're not in the running for anything, I'm completely happy with that.
Yeah.
So, I mentioned it at the top of the show that, you know, you're always sure that there are things that are going to fail. And we'll get to Combat Patrol, which did not fail. I felt Combat Patrol went well. But while we were setting up and getting ready for Combat Patrol, we were looking out at all the tables that were set up, and we'd been trying to distribute our terrain as evenly as possible. And we looked and like, yeah, this, where did all, we had more terrain last year than we needed. Where did all that terrain go? Fortunately, we remembered we had three boxes of it still here at Dennis's house.
But also the point is we also had more tables this year.
Right.
And I don't think we accounted fully for that. And so we will need to do a better job of getting more taller terrain things.
And even with adding, like, I added a good, you know, as I built more line of sight blocking terrain pieces, and it's still, I mean, it's better, but we need more. And I think one of the big takeaways from that is that hills are not a useful piece of terrain anymore. Absolutely not. They're unless you build like tall monolithic hills that are just there to block line of sight,
and then it's not really a hill anymore.
Yeah.
Yes, and I know Kevin, Andrew, and I talked about this pre-show a little bit, so I'll re-hit the highlights. Basically, it comes down to there is a very easy way to repurpose those hills into being useful, and it's to have large monolithic hills that are capable of hiding, you know, one or two Land Raiders, or at least obscuring, if not outright hiding, an Imperial Knight behind them. And for those, the easy way to repurpose them is to go buy like small scale trees or shrubs, right? Or create them on your own and just kind of plant them in there and be like, look, this is, you know, now a large hilly forest. Woo! Infantry gets cover and big things can hide behind it. Done. Right. So, yes, hills by themselves naked on page. It's either 249 or 248. I forget off the top of my head which one hills are described on. But it's one of those two. And it's hills literally do nothing. They do not do anything. They are not a cover providing terrain feature. They are just that. They are only a terrain feature. They don't actually do anything in terms of mechanics, which is. Not so bueno. But if you just, you know, throw some shrubbery and stuff on it and be like, hey, look, now it's a forest and also a giant hill.
Yeah.
But it's a forest.
Hey now, they hide my 3/4-inch tall rippers very well.
Yeah, of course they hide your 3/4-inch rippers very well. So does my nail clippings. So you know what?
You need to clip your nails more often. I'm just saying.
I mean, I'm a lazy bachelor, so maybe not.
He's basically Nosferatu.
Oh, and it's page 251, by the way.
Damn it!
You were so close. So close.
I was so close.
But
I should have just gone with my gut.
But yeah, you're right. You know, hills, basically, they don't offer cover. They're just part of the battlefield, unless they can block visibility. So, yeah. So
add a shrubbery.
Do you have to cut it down with a herring?
Yeah.
But yeah, so that is the challenge, is retooling our 7th edition terrain for 8th edition. So, you know, phasing out the hills or expanding them with trees and figuring out.
And if you're not, you know, an Adepticon, a Nova, LVO, right, you're going to have that struggle this year. Like, just straight up, that is going to be a struggle for the local events. Period. There's not really a quick and dirty or cheap way to fix that. So you're kind of stuck just going, well, this year terrain is still going to be kind of 7th ed. So we need to use our imaginations a little bit and patchwork whatever we can. And then we'll take whatever we can out of the entry money and go buy, you know, or upgrade our current existing inventory.
Or just pull a London GT and put bare styrofoam on the table.
No.
Ooh,
but I will say the furniture risers did, I think, a really good job.
Yeah, that one ended up working out. And I know, like, when I first posted it, there were people that were concerned that, like, so the furniture risers, they're like, it's basically like an 8-inch riser that can split into like a 5 and a 3. And they have what kind of look like battlements on top. So if you split them into the two smaller pieces, you could make the argument that, yes, you can put infantry on top, and then you get into the whole issue of unassaultable infantry. So to avoid that, we just did the full 8, and that was a large enough piece to hide just about anything behind. And those worked out really well. They're nice, big, solid pieces of terrain. And fortunately, I found a couple of extra sets of them at a local, like, overstock store. So I got so we ended up with, like, 12 risers for like $20 overall, like $25.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So, and then just, you know, prime them, spray, then go over them with like a stone finish spray, dry brush them, and they look fine. You know, they're perfectly serviceable. Now, I will say, I understand the struggle of the London GT in that I think they may have expanded too fast. Because they went from, what, like 100 players to like 300 players in 1 year?
450.
100 to 450. So, yeah, it just seems like they were not prepped for as many tables as they needed. Now, from what I understand, that bare styrofoam was still functionally decent line-of-sight blocking terrain, but definitely not pretty.
So, when you're faced with that, here's the lesson I'll take from the London GT. It's not to point and laugh or, you know, give them crap.
No.
It's these guys were put themselves in a very tight spot. And let's be honest about that part. They put themselves in that tight spot. They allowed this situation to go this way. Now, that doesn't mean that they should be, you know, just shamed into oblivion. What it means is that, you know, they made a mistake and we should all take the lesson to heart and learn from it. And that's, sometimes, yes, you may want to allow as many players as you absolutely positively can to come through your door. But at some point, you actually have to say no. You do not and should not sacrifice player experience for getting more feet in the door and more money in the bank. That's not what this hobby and running events has really been all about. Right. Yes, there are for-profit events out there, but even they, you know, have these hard limits that they're unwilling to surpass because that's the capacity at which they can operate. Right. For some, again, see previously mentioned Big Four, they have, you know, very large budgets with very large groups that are capable of doing all the things that they need done. But for most events, this is just not going to be true. And you really should have a pre-planned size that you're going to go to and just don't exceed it. Just don't. Don't do that to yourself unless you can find a source of cheap and easy stuff to get a hold of, preferably things that are already built and painted that, like, somebody from your local hobby, you know, your hobby store or somebody in your local playgroup has access to that you can add to your event with their permission. That sort of thing, then that's fine. But it really, if you're just trying to get more boots in the ground, more boots in the door, just go ahead and say no. It's like, it's just like drugs, kids. Just say no.
Well, and I also the Big Four events have grown organically too. You know, when they started out, with the possible exception of LVO, because they kind of started it as a headline event, but it was also frontline. They've been doing large events for years. But
yeah, at the BAO.
Right. So, I mean, they had kind of worked, you know, it was kind of the extension of that. But, you know, most of these events, they didn't start out as the biggest events in the world. They got there.
Yeah.
And I think that, and so, like, if London GT had gone from 100 players to 150 and then to 200, like, year after year and grown that way, then they would have been able to keep up with it. And, like, even us this year, like, we originally were going to go for 100 players, and I'm glad we didn't. I'm glad we backed off and said, well, if we're going to do that, we won't have room for some of the other events we wanted to run, which, unfortunately, both of the other events we wanted to run Infinity and X-Wing got canceled. Infinity because they ended up having two events pop up around ours, and so everyone was going to be Infinity'd out in our region before our event. And then X-Wing because right after we, you know, we really started pushing the event, Fantasy Flight revealed that X-Wing 2 was coming out, and X-Wing 1 was now completely irrelevant. So, yeah, that pretty much killed those for now. Although I understand your X-Wing 2.0 event for Renegade is already sold out, so kudos on that.
Yeah, our new guy running that stuff is, he's our real estate agent by trade, so...
He knows how to promote stuff.
Yes, and in fact, he asked us specifically at the first meeting for this year, so what was your fastest selling event? We're like, 3 days, it was Bolt Action. Okay, I'm going to beat that. I'm going to do that in half the time.
And
sure enough,
did.
Half the time, he did it.
but
yeah, good on him. We struck gold with that guy.
But anyway, yeah, so we rolled it back to 80, and then we actually ended up expanding to 80. We managed to squeak out three extra tables and expanded it to 86 to take care of our waiting list. And we ended up with 83, which then became 77. So we ended up kind of where we wanted to be anyway, which was a few players more than last year. And we're kind of finding that that's kind of a sweet spot for us right now. So yeah, there's definitely something to be said for holding at the level that you think you can honestly maintain and still provide a good experience. If we had stretched any further, I think the overall experience definitely would have suffered, even if we would have had just a few more players.
Yeah, absolutely. And that absolutely should be the lesson that we all take away from the unfortunate situation that happened at the London GT, mm-hmm. right? Yep, there were lots of pictures. We all had our laughs. Nobody should say, hey, I didn't do anything. No, we all had our laughs. But now the laughs are over. Let's learn the lesson here. Let's not have anybody else be the unfortunate victim of this situation.
Right.
Right. And that's to do exactly as you pointed out. Just make sure that you understand your own limits and you adhere to them. Don't try to go bigger than you actually have the capacity to do.
Well, so that begs the question, Dave. How many are we going to have at Renegade this year?
That depends. Are you talking total number of attendees or one singular event?
I'm talking about the 40K GT. What do you think our upper limit is?
96.
96?
Yep, 96, because that'll put everybody in the main hall. We won't have to have overflow. And it guarantees that everybody who wanted to be part of that will get to be part of that, and that if we have space for walk-ins, then that's fantastic, and we don't have to shove them off into La La Land, and possibly even to inferior tables so that they don't get to have their fun.
Plus, we'll have the friendly, the narrative, combat patrols. It's going to be a lot of other stuff going on, too.
Yep, but, we'll talk about that another time.
Let's switch over to combat patrol, because we ran our first combat patrol event at Midwest Conquest this year using.
Yeah, who won that?
Yeah, that would be you. That would be you. Which is funny because you also created the first draft of the format that we're using. So, not that saying you had inside information, but I think you understood the format better than most.
I understood that 20 Gene Stealers was going to be a very effective unit. I was right.
Yeah, there's very, very few people are going to be able to bring enough to deal with that in the format. So for anyone who doesn't know, Combat Patrol, the format we used, which again was created by Andrew Teagues here, 400 points. The four sword chart is 1-3 troops, 0-1 elite, 0-1 fast attack, 0-1 heavy support, and 0-1 flex spot, which can be one of troop, elite, heavy, or fast attack. No HQs, you'll notice. Also, at Renegade, you had the limitation of no named characters. And based on the feedback you gave us from running your event, we adjusted that to being no characters whatsoever.
And yeah, guard player kind of ran away with it with a lot of, because there's a few characters that guard can take that are not HQs, and basically kind of made him be able to do a bunch of tricks that nobody else could do. So, yeah, he had to get rid of that. And then also, we also allow dedicated transports, but you can only take one if you also have a unit that can actually ride in it.
Right, which we had one player realize on his second game that, oh, crap, I took two Star Weavers from my Harlequins and only one troop. So he dropped after that. But other than that, I think everybody kind of had the format down. And then we also took your advice, and we did not run the relic as a mission.
Oh, God, what a mistake that was. it's just bad. And yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, it's
but,
okay.
Yeah, good on you guys for getting rid of it. But yeah, you know, it's with combat patrol, it does definitely change the game dynamic. You know, only four rounds instead of, you know, five or six or seven. And having so many fewer troops on a smaller board, a lot of the games really went very quickly. It's, you know, 40K in less than an hour.
Right. I don't think.
And did any games at Midwest Conquest go the full hour?
We had a couple that got close that finished at like 50. You know, they turned in scores at like 55 minutes, but I think most games were done within 40. With 8th edition, it is just such a brutal, bloody, you know, edition, and the armies are so small that, yeah, there were a lot of tablings.
Which is why I'm trying to plan ahead for Renegade Open to try and think of a couple more missions where, you know, kind of do the thing where just because you've tabled your opponent, maybe you don't necessarily get max points. There should be a few things that you accomplish during the game that earn you points. One idea that I had that I was bouncing off Kevin before the podcast started was maybe you get 1 point per objective you hold, but you only get 1 point per turn and 1 point per objective on the table. So all four turns, you got to hold all four objectives on those four turns. That's going to be hard for anybody to pull off. And tabling your opponent won't automatically get it for you. It's just, you know, just kind of more ideas to try and say, how's a way we can make the game a little more dynamic than just do whatever you can to table your opponent?
Right, right. And, I mean, for the most part, I mean, you could definitely tell people were playing to the objectives. It's just that in the midst of playing to the objectives, there was a lot of killing that was going on. But no, it seemed like everyone had a good time. I'm hoping we had eight players. Actually, I think we had
nine.
We had nine, so we had a ringer, and then we had one drop, so then the ringer dropped. So we ended with eight. So we ended up going three rounds instead of four, because with eight players, three rounds gives you a one undefeated. But yeah, the games were fast. Everyone seemed to have a good time, and hopefully we'll get more people coming next year for it. It's definitely a format I recommend, and we'll get a packet with the missions that we ran up online for people to take a look at, so they can run it themselves. And, you know, always willing to collect more feedback and see what people think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I really recommend it, because sometimes you want to play a quick game of 40K with a buddy, but you don't have 2 to 3 hours. You only have an hour. Combat Patrol is a great way to just get a game in real quick and not have to put a huge time investment into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, especially if you're somebody who's like just starting out with like a start collecting box or a couple of squads, I mean, it's something that it's very easy to jump into.
Well, like, yeah, I've considered buying 400 points worth of an army that I don't normally play just to paint up a combat patrol and run it, just because I want to try and expand it, but I don't want to, you know, invest in 2000 points of an army.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for a lot of those ancillary forces that you then might work into a larger army as a patrol, for example.
Yep. Yeah, it's fun.
Let's see. And then we also had our Night Joust. And as you mentioned earlier, the Night Joust ended up going way later than I think we originally intended. And one of the reasons was we had 20 players.
Which is the
yes,
biggest
we did.
Amount of players I've seen in a Night Joust.
Yeah. First lesson learned is if you have that many players, split them between two tables. So instead of having two teams of 10 going at it, you have two tables of 5 versus 5, because a 5 versus 5 game goes a lot quicker, and then have the winners of each table play off. It was also interesting in that we had two players in that initial batch of 20 that asked if instead of bringing a regular knight or some other PL 29 or less Titanic unit if they could bring a pair of knight armigers. And we looked at it and it's like, well, let's see. Two armigers are PL24, which is the same as a knight. They're 24 wounds, same as a knight. They degrade, similar to a knight. They have a 5-up ion shield, similar to a knight. They've got together about the damage output of a knight. Sure, why not? It'll be fun. And it was definitely an interesting experience to watch players react to. You've got to watch both of these things zipping around, and they do zip around because they are very fast. And they're small enough that they tend to kind of, especially in that first round where it's just insanity, and there's, you know, 20 knights on the field, you know, or 20, actually in this case it would have been 22 knights or, you know, units running around the table, that it's easy for those little ones to get lost in the flow of things. But they ended up being decently effective, and yet at the same time ignored, because everyone goes for, like, goes to hunt down the Lord of Skulls or the Atropos or, you know, whatever big, nasty Forge World or otherwise monstrosity is stomping around the table. So as the Knight Joust format goes, you start with your everybody at the table going, winning side gets split in half, winning side of that gets split in half again, and you keep going and keep going until only two players are left, which is why with 20, we ended up going, what, 5 rounds?
Yeah, 20 to 10, then down to 6, then down to 4, then down to 2, and then finally a winner.
Yeah. And the final match ended up being Ladies' Night, which was awesome to see, because it was Cheryl Matheson, who was piloting the, in fact, it was the charity knight that Alex Hunt had painted for our Mechanicus army, versus Nell Roberts, who is the daughter of Pat Roberts, who runs Peculiar Games Hobby, who was one of our major prize sponsors for Midwest Conquest. And she was running a pair of armigers. And this was actually her first set of 40K games. Her brother plays, but this was her first introduction to the game. And yeah, first introduction was being thrown into a knight joust with 19 other players, but she managed to take it all the way to the end. And had a couple of dice rolls gone differently in that final one-on-one match, Nell could have easily come out the winner. It was a very good set of, it was just a very neat set of games. There were some, there was a, the semifinals ended up being, men versus women, and Alex Hunt and Cheryl ended up like just trading shots at each other with a pair of crippled knights, both that are sitting at about 6 wounds, hitting on 5s, and, just waiting to see who was going to fail a save first. Yes, it was exhausting, but it was also really fun to watch. But again, lessons learned. There are ways to accelerate that so that it doesn't go quite so fast. The other thing is the other option is to cap it at 16. So again, yeah. You know, you want to make sure player experience is good. And part of that is to put a cap at your event so that it doesn't just go overboard. But I think we were just kind of enamored with how many people signed up, and we actually got like several last minute signups, and I think that's what pushed it into crazy territory.
Fun fact: my Tyranid Knight was the first to die in the first 2 rounds.
Yeah, it was.
I don't know what you're talking about. It's not like some bald bastard on the other team gave the order: kill the bug, kill it with fire.
How dare you! Hey, now, it was the Lord of Skulls that killed me round 2.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That is fair.
But again, that's one of those game formats that is just, it is insanity, it is a lot of fun, and the environment that it brings of everybody like just cheering each other on, and then and just like I said, the sheer insanity of the first round, and then that led to careful strategizing in later rounds. And that's one thing that slowed things down a bit, is people were being very strategic.
One thing I did like that, and the fact that you had people who did not know each other before the Knight Joust started, and here they were on a team talking with each other about strategy. I found that really neat to watch, and it's like, hey, people are like becoming friends with strategy over Knight Jousts.
Yeah. No, that... And that's what, that's 40K at its best. I think when you've got two people who have never met each other before and are bonding and becoming friends over the gameplay, that is what you want out of this hobby. So that was really awesome to see.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we play games.
Exactly.
And then I guess, did you mention our winners overall?
No, I have not mentioned the winners overall. For the GT, our third place was last year's winner, which was Sam Henley. He, like I said, he brought Necrons. Second place was Trent Northington, who brought Demons. Actually, I think, did he bring Thousand Suns? Yes, because he had
Pyroclus. Yeah, it was Thousand Suns, Demons.
Yeah.
Zangors and Magnus.
That's right. Yeah. And then first place was Richard Windau from St. Louis, from the Gateway Gamers Club, and he was bringing Tau. So it was like him and Sam at the last he and Sam were at the top table, and the way the points shook out, it's like whoever won that game was taking first, obviously, whoever, and then Trent won his game, so whoever lost was going to take third. And then with the addition of painting scores, Trent ended up getting best overall and taking home the wonderfully painted Thanos orc that
Thanork.
That Richard crafted.
That was real fun to make.
Yeah, we'll have to get pictures of that. I think that's going to have to be the header picture of the show.
Yeah,
it is. So you have to get me some pictures of Thanork. So that, whereas in past years we've had a knight or Bobby G for best overall, this year we had Thanork. Those were the winners of the GT. I don't have the list in front of me of all the best of faction that we did, and I admit I flubbed up the Tau one because when I was calculating it, and I had the overall tab switched on, which changed the Tau one. So
lessons learned.
Lessons learned. This was our first year of entering soft scores in Best Coast Pairings, because before that, it was an option, but it was an option they added this past year or this year, but you had to set up the event ahead of time with it. And in the couple of weeks before the event, they had the ability to go in and edit an already set up event and add soft scores, which was very useful. And again, kudos to Dan, our data entry guy, for going through and entering in every round sportsmanship score and all the painting scores. So,
is that available online? I want to see my painting score.
I don't know if I've up, I sent it off to Frontline for ITC scoring. I don't know if I've put it online, but I will. Yeah. Again, although that was weird that they've changed how the tokens work. You don't enter in a token and submit it at the end. You apply a token from a collection of tokens for a particular game system to an event, but I didn't do that until after the fact. But I think all those scores are in, so they should be reflected on ITC at this point. Although I don't know do they have their hobby track going yet?
Yes, they do.
All right, so hopefully
the hobby track is alive and well.
So hopefully those will be reflected in the hobby track. And then
maybe throw a mention out to our best painted then.
Oh yes, yes. And this one, okay, so I know there's been some questions about this one, and this was tight. We had four armies that were all really, really solid. So we had a really fantastic Tau army with an awesome light up display board, which I had seen at Flying Monkey. In fact, the Marshall, I would say Van Nortwick, who had that army, brought it to Flying Monkey last year. He won Best Painted with that, and that got him the ticket to Midwest Conquest. It was probably about a 3 foot tall display board with canopy and lights and everything. Looked really sharp.
And all those bases matched all the thing.
Yeah. It was fantastic. Had Alex Hunt, who is a friend of the show, has been a guest on the show, painted painted Ferris Manus for us last year, painted the charity night night for our charity Mechanicus Army this year. He had easily the best display board Marshall had a fantastic one. When I'm saying best, it's some of these are by degrees, but he had a very impressive display board with a whole side story and, purity seal for his Grey Knights and Imperial Knights army, with a lot of little conversions and a lot of little details. We had Sam Bennett, who had a Necron army, which had a really neat display board. It was basically like swamp Necrons, had really impressive water work on the base, including like his display board had a monolith rising up out of the swamp. So he had like taken a monolith and cut it in half and glued it into the,
And some Necrons crawling out of the water. Yeah, there were sides. It was really neat.
And then we had Kevin Lynn, who had an Imperial Fists army. And I will admit, the first time, like when I went through the paint scoring, I'm like, okay, that's really good. And then I
remember like as it was on your side of the
painting
the room.
Yeah.
So that was the one that you initially scored. But I remember as I was walking around on Floor Judge. And I saw that army, and it stuck out to me.
Yeah, it's one of these armies that's like, first off, it's Imperial Fists. It's bright yellow. Yep. So it's eye-catching. And then it was one of these things I kept coming back to it and looking at it. And I looked at all of them and tried to look at all the details. And on all the armies, the more you looked at them, the more things you would find. And so that's the sign of a really well done army is the more you look at it, the more neat things you're finding about them. Yeah. And that's true for all of the armies I've named so far. None of these people should, whether they won or not, none of these people should feel bad. These were all four of these that I've listed so far are fantastic armies. Kevin's hat was yellow. It was a very strong, consistent yellow throughout.
Yes.
It had good edge highlighting and shading on yellow, which is hard to pull off. It had great
nice stenciling use.
Yes, airbrush stencil. He used a few, a couple of decals on vehicle doors, but otherwise, all his logos were either sculpted or airbrush stenciled. Good weathering details. And again, all the, Marshall's was a nice, dirty, gritty tau, which is something you don't see very often.
Yeah.
Obviously, Sam's are Necrons coming out of the swamp. So again, lots of swamp and mud effects. Yeah, Alex's Grey Knights are fighting off corruption, so their armor is chipped and worn. And Alex is a master of weathering. Anyone who has seen a knight that Alex has painted can attest to that. And Kevin's wasn't heavily weathered, but it had a lot of the dirt weathering on vehicles, dirt kicked up where dirt would be kicked up, things like that. He was using the Imperial Castle and Strong Points, the Forge World, Space Marine Strong Point board as his display board, but it was painted nicely and worked in with the army. All the armies looked good with their display boards.
Effective use of that crackling base texture.
And so in the end, I've got these four armies. They're all neck and neck on painting scores. They're all really, really close. So that's when we brought in a couple of people who, we brought in Kevin, who had not paint judged anything yet. And then we brought in our friend Brady, who has been actually teaching painting classes at Peculiar Game and Hobby.
Yes.
And has actually become a pretty accomplished, pretty decent painter.
Yes.
So we brought him in. He doesn't know any of these people, so there's, no sense of bias whatsoever. And he looked at all of them. And it was real close between it was real close between Alex and Kevin's, and we ended up coming to consensus, and by one painting point, we went with Kevin Lynn, took home best painted. But like I said, none of the people who were in that top running should feel at all bad. They were all fantastic, and it was it took us a good half hour of looking at those four armies to come to a winner. So kudos to everyone who put up their armies for paint judging. There were some very just fantastic looking armies this year. And paint judging is one of the hardest things, no matter what matrix you're using, because a paint matrix or paint rubric will not always reflect all the detail and work that somebody's put into it. And there's a lot of subjectivity to it. So that's why it's good to bring in multiple, especially on those tough decisions, bring in multiple judges and try to reach a consensus, because it's easy for one person to, it's easy to fall into the trap of one person decides, I like this one best. And that's the one I like it best, so I want that one to win. So
right.
So yeah. So Kevin Lin won our best painted, and that was easily as tough a competition as some of the gameplay competitions, I think. So, and I think, oh, and then best, I want to throw Duncan Ensminger from the Flying Monkey GT won our best sportsman also. He was, like I said, we had really good sportsmanship scores all around. Duncan was the only person to have three of his, so half of his opponents list him as their favorite opponent. So he had top scores plus lots of player recommendations. So I have no problem giving him best sportsmanship.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate because now Bam Bam can't give him as much crap for being a cruddy player and telling people to F off.
but he's a great player that people enjoy playing, so can't complain about that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Now Bam can't complain about it. Because before, he's always been like, welcome to the Flying Monkey. You shouldn't be listening to this at work and yada yada, right?
Right.
He's like, yeah, this is very much an adult podcast. And he slams on... I mean, those two guys are very, very good friends, right? They've known each other for a very long time. But they go through some just hateful things are said to each other. And one of them has always been, well, yeah, but Dunkalicious, you don't win nothing. And it's like, damn, man. I mean, come on.
Yeah, now that's not true.
That's not true anymore.
That's absolutely not true.
Well, yeah, I don't know that that'll stop Bam Bam from
actually No, it won't.
No, God, no. God, no. I don't think a semi coming out head on at him at 55 would stop him. He'd just jujitsu chop the thing and it would fall apart. For those of you who don't know who Bam Bam is because you don't listen to the Flying Monkeys podcast or you've never been to Flying Monkey or Iron Halo or Midwest Conquest, he is a part-time sheriff, and he also teaches jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
With a very, very adult themed flair for doing so.
I mean, it's the Honey Badger Dojo, I believe. So I mean,
yes,
that is
the Honey Badger Dojo, and where we don't give no fucks.
Yeah.
No, he does actually have those some very kid friendly courses. So we know that he can hold his tongue. It's just very obvious in places that he doesn't when he doesn't want to.
Oh no,
or need to.
No, but Bam Bam's awesome. He was on our last Iron Halo show from October. So check that episode out if you want to hear a little bit more from him there. And I'm sure we'll have him on again. And he was on our show a few episodes back talking about Flying Monkey coming up. So
yeah
we've had Brian Bam Bam Hunter is a friend of the show. So as much as he may pop that attitude, he's actually a really cool guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure he is. In fact, he won Iron Halo's best sportsmanship last year.
So this is a trend for Flying Monkeys. They win sportsmanship.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what happens when you buy your opponent's beers and then drink them with them.
Are you saying that my distribution of the Jameson did nothing?
I'm saying that perhaps you should use a different liquid lubricant.
Beer instead of whiskey. Got it.
Although the Jameson was quite good. I could feel it in my ears.
That's not I think you were drinking drink it wrong.
No. I drank it and it immediately went, you know, it aerosolized and went up my tubes into my ears. And it was like, wow, that's good stuff right there. No, that was definitely not apple juice you were offering me.
I had fun being the whiskey fairy over the weekend, you know, going from table to table.
It was fantastic. It was a fun event. So I take it you guys had a good time.
A great time. And, it was my first Midwest Conquest. I know Dave's been there multiple times, but for me, it was my first time ever down to Kansas City. And I can't wait to come again next year.
Well, awesome. Dave, did you have a good time despite your losing record?
I had a fantastic time despite my losing record. And, you know, I love Kansas City, and they're not paying me or nothing, but you should go visit Arthur Bryant's if you ever find yourself in Kansas City, Mo, because they're delicious. Absolutely delicious every year.
I think by this point, your crew has done a tour of, all the major bar – almost all the major barbecue places in KC.
All the ones that you have ever recommended to us.
Oh, so you're saying we need to get you a longer list.
That is what I am saying. Because I demand more and varied flavors of ribs.
Because, let's see, you've done Jack Stack, you've done Gates, you've done Arthur Bryant's. Have you done Q39?
That was year one.
And Joe's.
And Joe's, yep. Q39 and Joe's were the two that we visited the first Midwest Conquest. The last three that you mentioned before that, we went to last year. And then this year we went to Jack's and Arthur Bryant's. And it was fantastic. So we need a longer list.
We'll get you more.
Yeah.
Excellent.
If you are a fan of the cooked meats, you will enjoy eating in Kansas City. There's a lot of really good barbecue places. And if you're a vegetarian, did you know Joe's does a portobello Z-Man sandwich?
Yes, I did.
I didn't before we got there, but yes. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
And
so
I'm told it's good. I will never know because I demand meat because, I'm meat and potatoes. I'm Irish. Give me.
Just saying.
And be sure to come up to the Renegade for some hot dish and lutefisk.
I'd rather not.
No. What are you trying to do? Scare people away? Next thing you're going to do is tell them about how cold it is.
Well, it's not like we're holding it in November or anything.
Oh, wait.
I mean, shit.
So Dave, you're pretty much just telling us that the sky is blue and water is wet, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And I think on that note, that is a perfect point to end the show.
Yay.
So Andrew, Dave, as always, thanks for being on the show, and I'm glad you guys had a good time. And
oh, welcome. It's always fun.
And we're going to do it again next year. We'll see where another year of big FAQs and codex releases and whatever happens after all the codexes are done. We'll see what happens, what the environment looks like in a year when we run it again. But I'm excited for it. We're taking June off, and then I think we start planning in July for the next one. So watch this space for news on Midwest Conquest 2019. It will be coming, and we will have the Night Joust. We will have Combat Patrol, and hopefully we'll have some other events too. We've got some stuff, some ideas kicking around. I don't want to announce anything else too prematurely, but there's some possibilities coming down the pipe. So watch this space for 40K and otherwise news for the Midwest Conquest. And with that, from all of us here at Preferred Enemies, I'm Rob. Kevin lost signal, so we don't have a Kevin.
And Dennis.
And Richard.
Good night, good gaming, and another GT.
Get your ass to the 2019 Midwest Conquest.
I was going
to
say.
And sign ups for the Renegade Open are live. So RenegadeOpen.com.
Yes, absolutely sign up for RenegadeOpen.com. Good night, everybody.
Preferred Enemies is an Under Gopher Radio production and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 Unported License. Our theme music is Metal Slug 2 Super Vehicle 001/2 No Need to Reload, originally by Takushi Hayamuda and remixed by Roataka, courtesy of OC Remix. It can be found at ocremix.com.